Warning, the Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. And here he is, Michael Savage.
Why have you not been able to create a bipartisan atmosphere here? And do you take any of the blame on yourself for that?
Well, you know, I think that if you look at my track record over the last 4 years, I have consistently sought compromise, sometimes to the point where Democrats have been mad at me, but I didn't care because I did what I thought was best for the country.
See you later, alligator.
It is the Savage Nation. Everyone's listening to me now to see what my magic is, and I'm not going to give my secrets away. But look, as the most skeptical talk show host in America, it's hard to be skeptical at every turn. And so sometimes I have to stop being skeptical. And what I'm doing this week is at the 34 mark in each hour, I'm going to give you some of my great Savage Golden Oldies. I did them last night. The results were great. I got letters from Robert De Niro, Martin Scorsese, yeah, right, offering to make movies out of Dead Man's Pants and the Yon Man's Cancer. In fact, Scorsese is saying that his next hit will be Dead Man's Pants. Can he have it for $10 million? Not. But it doesn't matter who likes it. They're wonderful stories, and I'm going to do them to break up the monotony of this endless budget debate. But I want to tell you about the budget debate, even though I didn't want to talk about the budget debate. It's about the budget, stupid. Here's what it comes down to in case you've been blindsided by Obama's silver tongue and Nancy Pelosi's vicious tongue and Barbara Boxer's demented tongue. When I was a kid in Jamaica High School, Queens, New York, we had history, civics, like everyone else, and we had review books where we would review for the Regents exams. And one of the topics that I remember, and I don't know whether it was Democrats or Republicans, it applied to the words pork barrel spending. And it stuck with me all these years. Who remembered? It's a blur. I'm not pedantic. I never liked pedantic teachers. I don't like pedantic talk show hosts who wrap themselves in the Constitution every minute. They remind me of the Marxist professors I had posing as conservatives now. I don't like pedantry. I don't like pedantic discussions. But what stuck out from the review books in my high school class was a description of pork barrel spending. And what it is, if you look it up, is this. It's slang. A bill or project requiring considerable government spending in a locality to the benefit of the legislator's constituents who live there. Let me repeat that. Government, politics, diplomacy, pork barrel spending. Slang, U.S. slang, a bill or project requiring considerable government spending in a locality to the benefit of the legislator's constituents who live there. The term originally applied to the federal treasury, considered as a source of lucrative grants. And I said to myself, wait a minute. If they had one articulate Republican instead of these stumble-bum pink-tie-wearing drunks who get up and said, look, ladies and gentlemen, you're confused by Obama's tremendous skills as an orator. But don't be confused. He is the party of drunken spending. We are the party trying to rein in pork barrel spending. It's that simple. And if somebody had explained it to the American people, I can guarantee you the country would be in a better place today. And the Democrats would be on the defense, not on the offense. And Nancy Pelosi with her big hammer and Barbara Boxer with her psychopathic mouth, her big stupid mouth calling everybody who she doesn't like civil war. I can't believe what she said. Listen to Barbara Boxer today in clip one. You won't believe this.
Never question the fact that Republicans, Democrats, and independents love this country.
You don't love this country. You love nothing.
But I have to say, when you start acting like you're committing domestic abuse, you've got a problem.
Well, you must be talking from personal experience, Barbara. I'd hate to be on the bad side of you on a Sunday morning. I mean, I know nothing about domestic abuse, but apparently it's in your mind for you to bring it up. Now, this is an example of the kind of stupidity that passes for political talk today. I don't know whether they suffer from ADHD and should be on medication, or if they're on medication for ADD or ADHD, But the fact of the matter is, it's simple. The Democrats are engaged in obscene pork barrel spending, a bill or project requiring considerable government spending in a locality to the benefit of the legislators' constituents who live there. Of course, the legislators' constituents in Boxer and Feinstein's and Reed's districts love pork barrel spending. Of course they love Obama because he buys their favors. But there is a price to be paid, and the price is taxation without representation, which is what the Tea Party is all about. And these pushers, these welfare pushers, these welfare peddlers are peddling a dangerous drug. Welfare is a very dangerous drug to peddle. Pork barrel spending is a very dangerous drug to peddle, because the recipient or the user of pork barrel spending knows no limits to their greed, and they want more and more and more. Once they get that fix, they want more and more and more. And that, my friends, is all I'm going to say on this whole budget debate this evening, which goes into overtime once again with Obama, the superb orator, coming out thinking that he's the hero. And it's not that he's the hero. He's a great orator because he has no opposition. He is opposed by who? Cantor? Forget about it. Cantor probably, in my day, would have been a decent junior college professor. Or perhaps if he had a rich uncle who owned Cantor's Deli in L.A., okay, could have been not behind the counter with the white apron, with the corned beef. No, not today. He'd be a floor walker in Cantor's Deli, walking around asking you how the pickles are, how's the knish, how you like the borscht. We don't get much call for it anymore, but I can see you're an expert on borscht. Do you like it? That's the job for Cantor. He looks more and more like a Jewish pallbearer. Cantor's looking more and more like he's at a Jewish funeral. I don't understand what happened to him. 2 years ago, he was swarthy, marching around, chest puffed out. He looks shrunken like he's at a funeral somewhere in Bensonhurst. And the corpse is about to come up from the tomb. And Boehner. What can you say about Boehner? Well, he went from the pink tie the other day, the surrender monkey tie. Now he's got the blue tie on, in case you were confused. It's sad. They're all good men. I know they all love America. Just Boxer loves the country, too. I mean, her and her husband, Stu Boxer, they're the greatest patriots you could ever imagine. Just look into the land deals in the Bay Area, and you'll see what patriotic citizens they are. They love America so much that they are so deeply involved in the soil of this country, you can't imagine. No, they're all patriots. You see, but in America, the streets are not paved with gold. The streets are paved with yolds. That's old German for fool. Just look it up. What else is in the news? There are some other news stories. I'm not ready to jump yet, nor am I ready for the golden oldies. So here are some questions for the Savage Nation. Today, a Medal of Honor winner asked to return to duty. And if you watch the ceremony of the cynical Obama pinning the Medal of Honor on William D. Swenson, you saw several things. You saw the most cynical president in American history, a man who grew up hating America's military, a man who grew up hating the police, a man who hates guns, hates bullets, hates ammunition. And why did he suddenly give a Medal of Honor to this hero? The man committed his life to save his fellow troops during a battle against the Taliban in 2009. He risked his life to help save his comrades, simply to retrieve the bodies of four Americans who were killed during the seven-hour battle on September 8, 2009. He is the first Army officer to receive the U.S. military's highest valor award since the Vietnam War. Why would this military-hating president of ours give him the Medal of Honor today? It's quite simple. Look at what Obama did last week. He closed the Vietnam and World War II memorials to veterans. He violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. He violated the codes which say that you have to have handicap access. He committed elder abuse against World War II veterans. It created such an outcry that even his minions who hate the military said, uh-oh, Barry, you better do something quick to regain a few of those military votes. What can we do? So the girls who advise him, the four horsewomen of the apocalypse, said, I don't know, get one of them out here and give him a medal. What medal? I don't know. Get one of them out. Get him out here. Who? Get one of them out of here. One of the idiots who went in the, one of the idiots who shoot the guns in Afghanistan. Give them some kind of award that everyone will notice you. You're the commander in chief again. Get some of them out of here. And they did research and they got a real hero and they gave him an award. It was the most cynical granting of a Medal of Honor I've ever seen in my entire life. That's why it happened today. And that's why I'm telling it to you. We're living in the most cynical times of all. It's not pleasant to look at these things. But you have to do it. Someone has to do it. And I ask myself every morning as I prepare for the show beginning at 6:30 in the morning, every morning like clockwork, the sun comes up even though I have blackout curtains. I'm on a diurnal cycle like every other mammal. And the minute that light peers through the curtain, no matter what, and a little bit of the beer from the night, you know, the bladder. What, I don't want to get into details. I'll make it classy. I'm on a diurnal cycle the minute the sun pierced through the curtain. I get up and stretch, and I do 500 push-ups, and I brush my teeth with Colgate. No, I don't. I get up, and I stumble into the... The thing is, I get up at 6:30 every morning, and within a few seconds, I'm on the Internet looking at what the damn Democrats have done to destroy my country and what they've done to steal from my paycheck again. And then I go and I have the coffee, etc. And it's such a long day's journey into night till I get on the air. 6 o'clock Pacific, 9 o'clock Eastern. It really is a long day's journey into night. And you got to be made out of some strong protoplasm to do what I do. After all these years, I'm still doing it with vigor. Why? Because I love it. What would I be doing if I were not here in front of this microphone right now? I would probably be in North Beach in San Francisco, probably going into a cafe filled with psychotic communist liberals who have not worked a day in their life, who are on crazy checks, SDSI. I know some of them. They sell a little pot on the side. God knows they have scams going. They don't make a lot of money. And they collect crazy checks, and they buy themselves every afternoon wine and beer and coffee. And they spit on America. They spit on the flags of the fallen. They sit with such hatred, and I say to myself, God save me from that, or else that's where I'd probably be, in the club where anyone is welcome, because nobody is anything. I'd be sitting like a sconce in a window, asking myself what I did wrong to wind up in this cafe talking to these American-hating communist losers on SDSI crazy checks. So I thank God that I had the votes to get this position, unlike John Boehner. I thank God that the tea is whistling in the background. Teddy is snoozing underneath the desk. And I thank God that God pulled me up, pulled me out, and put me in front of the microphone. The phone number here is 855-407-2282. I am talking about the simple division between the Democrats who are engaging in psychotic pork barrel spending and some of the Tea Party members and some of the Republicans, and all of the Tea Party members who are simply trying to stop the pork barrel spending. This is Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
If we put all the women, Republican and Democrat, in the House together, the consensus from all of us is that we would get this done in a few hours. You know, I would argue that even if Sarah Palin were in the room, that right, we could find a way to get to yes. Because
okay, unfair, I mean,
that's usually
Bob,
women's goal. Yeah.
This is the most deranged woman in the history of the U.S. Congress. How did she get where she is, Wasserman Schultz? I always try to think back to, if I were a kid, what she would be doing, the further she could have gotten. Wasserman Schultz, gym teacher the most, a nasty gym teacher with a whistle, yelling at girls, telling them to get in line, get in shape, climb that rope, do those push-ups, tote that barge, lift that bale. But today, I think she's a congressperson. So in other words, if you put all the women in a room together, they get to yes. That's really amazing. I mean, women don't argue with each other, Debbie. Is that correct? You may be the only woman on earth who believes that, especially with you in the room. Imagine her in the room with Barbara Boxer. Now, there are no Republican women that I know of. You're going to talk about, well, I don't even know, from Maine? Snow job? Forget about it. That's why I don't want to do too much politics. It's futile. It's why people are turning off radio, talk radio. They're listening to music. They're doing anything but listening to this gibberish. by and large. They can't take it. How much can you listen to this? I've said to you 1,000 times, and I'll say it again. Obama is the president. Boehner is the Speaker of the House. Are they the sun, the moon, and the stars? Are we primitives who are looking up at the sky? Do we not have a telescope to look beyond this constellation around the earth? There are other galaxies out there other than Obama, Boehner, Cantor, Debbie Schultz, Harry Reid. They're like dormant planets, these people, to me. They're like planets without water. Each one of them is like a planet without life on it. How long can you look at a planet that is arid? How long can you look at a planet without water, without an atmosphere? That's what looking at Obama is like. That's what looking at these politicians is it like. How long can you gape at planets without water, without an atmosphere? I can't. It's enough to drive a sane man crazy. And I'm sane, and I'm not going to be driven crazy by them. Of course I'll tell you what the news is. Of course I will. Of course I will. But and if I see a poignant point, as I did, that when Obama closed off the war memorials, the vets, because he's the most divisive, vindictive president in American history, when he closed off the war memorials to the World War II vets and the Vietnam vets, he not only exhibited his true self, but he violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. I don't know why that was not picked up on, other than I'm ignored and hated by everyone in the media because I'm a little more incisive than they would like. Let's put it that way. When January comes around, and God willing, I'm in drive time on the monster real estate that Cumulus owns across America, they're going to have to pay attention to me. And I will tell you that my insights will be approximately as they are now. So I'll take some calls on the Savage Nation. Remember at... Oh, we don't have time. See, I have to develop a thought. It takes a while. There's no script. Nobody writes the script in the morning for me. I'm not looking at a teleprompter. I'm not a politician. I'm not a didactic talk show host who doesn't know A from B or his feet from his hands. I can hear all of you loud and clear. I have the sharpest ears in talk radio history and the sharpest stethoscope in the history of modern American media.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
Politics is not theology. It's work. And the framers of the Constitution gave us a system that was supposed to produce honorable compromise after honest debate. Because nobody's got things right all the time. And the more complex problems are, the more you need people to work together.
You know, it almost sounds as though Bill Clinton is trying to tell Obama to stop being so rigid and inflexible. Remember, Bill Clinton was a master politician. Let's stop already with the cigars and the screwing around. He was a master politician. He was a compromiser. And by comparison, you would almost say Bill Clinton was somewhat not of a he was a centrist compared to this guy. You got to understand, Obama is out of the ken of normal politics. Obama is a far left radical who was completely out of the ken of not only of politics, but he's never been seen at a national level in the country's history ever. And Bill Clinton knows this. And Bill Clinton understands the danger his own party is in for being uncompromising. That's what I read from that. That's how I see it. Maybe you see it differently. 855-400-7282. I'm sitting here. It's nice. It's 10:15, 2013. You are hearing a spoon in a teacup. That must be a pleasant sound on radio. To hear a host stirring his tea early. The dog even like dogs. Imagine the dog sleeping on the mic table. I saw an article today on ADHD amongst women. I had to say, I got so furious because they're peddling drugs to poor women. It was in some website that pushes drugs under the guise of health. And it says, common symptoms of ADD and ADHD in women. And I said, oh my God, difficulty with boring repetitive tasks, spending time ruminating, difficulty making decisions such as skim 1%, 2% of whole milk, difficulty sitting still. Difficulty falling asleep and waking up the next morning. Poor sense of time. Starting projects but seeming unable to finish them. Taking on too much. Engaging in addictive behaviors like shopping. feeling low self-worth, hypersensitivity to criticism. I said, do they have no shame, these drug peddlers? These are not real symptoms. These are human emotions, the human reactions. And the drug peddlers called the pharma's Big Pharma in cahoots with Big Med have no limit to how far they want to go in peddling their drugs. I mean, by this definition, my dog Teddy has PDHD, poodle deficit hyperactivity disorder. I could apply these symptoms to my dog Teddy. I thought about it today on his walk. PDHD, poodle deficit hyperactivity disorder. Maybe they should prescribe medication for him. One, difficulty with boring repetitive tasks. Absolutely, check yes. Spending time ruminating. What do you think he's doing sleeping so much? Three, difficulty making decisions. Which bush shall he pee on? Four, difficulty sitting still. He never sits. He fidgets. Five, difficulty falling asleep and waking up the next morning. He does. He likes to play at night. Six, poor sense of time. He has no sense of time. He thinks he's immortal. He never thinks about death. Here's one, starting projects but seeming unable to finish them. That's Teddy to a T. I haven't seen him finish one model airplane since I bought him. You get the picture. You get the picture. They're trying to make poor women think that they have an illness to peddle drugs to them. You get it? And now, without further ado on the Savage Nation, as promised, we were going to play for you some Savage Golden Oldies. Hold on. Roll the drums. I got to build up to this. Because these stories are my favorites. It'll be what I'm remembered for, my vivid storytelling. Michael Savage is one of the most influential conservative voices in America, says the Washington Times. Washington Post says Savage recalls his childhood growing up in the Bronx. He's got the knack for evocative detail, features some indelible images, says the Washington Post. And these stories are all in my just-released paperback book, Train Track. So let's listen to which one, guys. What are we playing for the audience tonight? I don't know about Love by the Sewer Plant. That's not, I don't think. How about Louie and the Monkey, a favorite. Louie and the Monkey. Louie and the Monkey.
Louie and the Monkey story, which I told once at most in my tenure on radio. We go back now, ladies and gentlemen, put on your resting cap. We're going to go back in time. We're going back to the Lower East Side of New York. Dad owns a small antiques mart. Little old Michael's cleaning bronzes in the back, and there's Louis the Bum from the Bowery, who in those days, he was a drunk. He wasn't a bum. He worked. Dad would have him in on the weekends, and he'd clean the bronzes and whatever he did down there. I loved Louis. Louis was a great guy. But now you got to understand, this guy was a stoned alcoholic of the old school. Skinny like a rail. White guy, skinny like a rail, smoked like unfiltered cigarettes, but one of the nicest guys on earth. He wears the rubber apron, he's cleaning downstairs, does the bronzes, then of course I took over because Dad wanted cheap child labor, and where else are you going to get it from his son, you know. So I'm doing the things. So I got to know Louis over the years, and he taught me various things. Like once we had Louis over to the house, I'll never forget it, I was so proud that my father took this guy who I liked all the way out to Queens and invited him to dinner. I don't know what came over, maybe it was Thanksgiving or whatever. And Louis had dinner with us at the table, and the guy was surprisingly erudite, and he knew things. And, like, after dinner, we did games, and Louis the drunk showed me how to bend nails. He showed me mind over matter. He took a nail, and he showed me that if you put your fingers, blah, 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 and put your mind on it and keep up the pressure, the nail would bend. I was shocked because I was a skinny kid with little hands, and I bent the nail. And he taught me mind over matter, but it was all molecular because you put the heat and the pressure, blah, 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 eventually that nail is going to bend. But I learned in life it's the same thing. It's all willpower, okay? Now there's another element to the story. So Louis is this kind of guy, interesting, but an alcoholic, and this and that. Years go by. He lives alone in Williamsburg. In those days, Williamsburg was like a slum, zero, you know, oilcloth city, leftover apartments from the last century. No one wanted to be there but the poor. So he lives there alone. He's very lonely. He gets a monkey. He wants a monkey. Now, out of the world, nobody in those days had a monkey. Dogs, yes. Cats, yes. No. Who had a monkey in those days? Louis gets a monkey. But Louis don't just get a spider monkey, one of the skinny little monkeys. Louis gets a woolly monkey. Now, woolly monkeys are already strong. They got a chest on them. They got strong hands. And Louis's in love with this monkey. For a couple of months, they're inseparable. Wherever he goes, there's the monkey. And the monkey's on his shoulder and where he's cleaning and he's happy. Now, Louis was the kind of guy that if he went to a bar in the Lower East Side, I remember the name to this day, named Hamill and Corn. Whatever money he made for my father, he'd take 2 minutes later, he'd be in the bar, and he'd throw money in a jukebox, and he would whistle and sing, and he'd buy everyone drinks till he was broke. He'd stumble out in the street, he would get hit by a car, sleep on a bar, he didn't care, live for the booze, and that was it, but he had a heart of gold. So Louis gets the monkey, finally has someone to fill his empty nights. And as I say, they were inseparable. Well, as time went on, we get a call. Louis's in the hospital. He's dying. What? The monkey went crazy in his apartment, attacked him, and almost ripped him to pieces. And he suffered for 6 months in the hospital. I don't know which hospital. Probably Bellevue, because that's where they all wound up. And the monkey went at him. And look, you don't know what a monkey's like when it goes crazy. You try to stop an enraged monkey without a weapon. He ripped his neck. He ripped his face. He ripped his arms. He ripped his leg. He ripped his crotch. He ripped his behind. Louis was ripped up pretty bad, and eventually, he took the monkey. I think he grabbed it and threw it out of the window. It just shows you, if he hadn't done it, he'd be dead today, okay? But a liberal today probably would have tried to talk to the monkey. Louis knew that the instincts had to kick in. It was him or the monkey, and he decided it was better him than the monkey. He didn't consult a liberal book on how to deal with a crazed monkey. He just fought with it and killed it. I think that's what the bottom line is here. But the point is that even a lonely drunk needs companionship at night. In his case, he found the monkey. It was probably the right thing for him to do. So right now, you could see that Louis was a pioneer in a way, in a sense that he understood that monkeys were dangerous long before they did in India when they turned him into a sacred animal. And that's the Louis and the monkey story.
Savage. Not a bad story. I would change the ending a little bit, the laughter I cut out for the CD. But the bottom line is, as I point out on page 195 in Louis and the Crazed Monkey, even a lonely drunk needs companionship at night. And in his case, he found the monkey, and it was probably the right thing for him to do. All right, so what do? Monkeys are dangerous. It's as simple as that. And this is from my book, Train Tracks, The Family Stories for the Holidays in paperback. Maybe I should tell you happy and sad cufflinks when I was in the sixth grade. And I would tell you right now that if I was in a grade school today, in the sixth grade, they put me on every mind-controlling drug imaginable. ADHD is nothing compared to what they'd say I have. The mean-faced, clipped-haired women would say, that little savage, he has shining eyes and he talks too much. Put him on Ritalin. Put him on Adderall. Put him on Prozac. Put him in a straitjacket. He shows all the classic signs of being a boy. We must kill it. We must suppress it. We must crush it. Crush it. Crush it, I say. Drug it. Drug that maleness. I believe most mothers don't even know what their poor boys go through in school today. And when I was a young boy, my mother bought me a pair of cufflinks. They were a set of the thespian masks. You know, one was a sad face and one was a happy face. I love those cufflinks. I'd look at them when I was bored in class. On my right cuff, I had the happy face. On the left sleeve, I had the sad face. Some days I switched them around and put the happy face on the left sleeve and the sad face on the right sleeve. Many days I was so bored out of my mind, I didn't know what to do. I'd look at these cufflinks for hours in the classroom while the teacher was going on and on about George Washington, the Delaware River, the Constitution. I was so bored I spaced out. I learned that George crossed the Delaware. He saved the country in Trenton. He overthrew the British. I got that the first week of kindergarten. They're still teaching it to me in the fourth grade. In the fifth grade, I learned what a peninsula is. In the sixth grade, it took them a year to teach me what an island is. I couldn't take it. So I stared at the cufflinks, the happy face, the sad face. When I got bored with the cufflinks, I start pulling hair out of the skin of my arms. Today, they would have put me on Ritalin or put me in a bug house. They call my lack of attention a disease. It wasn't. It was called boredom, boys and girls. I'd inflict pain on myself by pulling hairs out of my arm rather than listen to the boring teacher bore me one more second talking about the Constitution. Rather than improve the curriculum or place bright kids in special classes, teacher today might say, oh, your son has something wrong with him, Mrs. Savage. We found out that he looks at cufflinks instead of listening to the teacher talk about how evil America is and why white males need to be put in the pillory. He's pulling hair out of his arm, and we suggest you put him on a moderate dose, just a moderate starter dose of Adderall. That's for starters. Soon the teacher might say, let's put him on Prozac. Now, I'd be the first to admit that teaching is a tough profession. Keeping the lesson engaging day after day takes everything out of you. As long as I live, I'll never forget the day I first walked into a classroom to teach. Maybe I'll write a book about it one day. You know, something for the students, I would call it The Savage Guide to Surviving Teaching. Anyway, back then, I didn't look much older than the students. I had graduated high school at 16, which means I, in turn, graduated college very young. Frankly, I decided to grow a goatee to look older than the junior high school kids in my first class. I remember when I raised my foot to walk over the curb that first day, to step into that junior high school, and my foot froze up. I actually stopped mid-stride. The students were racing past me to get to class, and I was standing there as stiff as a statue. I had no idea I had fear of teaching, but I did. If you think teaching is an easy job, try it someday. It is probably one of the toughest jobs on earth if you do it right. So when I'm critical about the teaching profession and the teachers' union, don't get me wrong, I fully recognize it's a tough drill. At the same time, there's no excuse for boring students to death. If an uneducated man like Woodchuck Bill could teach me about life, then surely I should be able to do the same with my college degree. At least that was my view as a beginning teacher. That's Happy and Sad Cufflinks from my paperback book, Train Tracks. All for you, free of charge, right now on the Savage Nation. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
Yeah, look, I think that there's been some progress on the Senate side Republicans recognizing it's not tenable, it's not smart, it's not good for the American people to let America default.
Okay, now you see, this is the big lie. He's a skilled politician, which is how he got where he is, but it's a big lie nevertheless. This is about the Democrats engaging in the most grotesque, obscene pork barrel spending in American history, period, not modern, in American history. And in the past, they would have been stopped a long time ago, but because a group of gangsters have seized control of the Democrat Party, and they are not being opposed to any extent, they are basically selling out the goods from the sporting goods store, as in the Sopranos episode. They're selling the goods out of this out of the sporting goods store. They're cashing in the credit cards. They're buying airline tickets on your dime, and they don't want to stop because there's no one to stop them. There's no Elliot Ness. There's nobody to stop them. You can't solely blame the Republicans. They're outmaneuvered, and I'll tell you why. You know, it's an interesting question. It's easy to call them this and that. It's not why the Republicans are losing in this debacle. It's because they're decent people. They're far more decent than the gutter rats in the Democrat Party, the street fighters. It's a criminal enterprise. The Democrat machine is fundamentally run like a criminal enterprise. It's as though the Republicans are still playing by Robert's Rules of Order. They're trying to negotiate. They're trying to say, look, give us something. The other side are like criminal gangsters. You can call it anything you want. It used to be known as the Russian School of Negotiation, which is you take one position, and once you get it, you change the goalposts. That was the Russian School of Negotiation. It's done all the time in business by hedge fund operators, by Wall Streeters, by lawyers. It's the game they play. So the Republicans should be used to that, but now it's gone to another level. It's no longer being run in that manner simply by hard litigators. The Democrat Party is being run as though it's being run by Al Capone and a group of gangsters who realize that there's nobody to oppose them. So they're saying, you know what, we love the trillions of dollars. We've never had it so good. These schmucks are never going to be able to stop us, so screw them. And that's what you see going on here. But if the American people understood what was really at stake, those of us who work and pay taxes would be clear that we're never voting for this criminal class of spenders again. It doesn't mean we love the Republicans. It means that at least they're trying to rein in the spending. The pork barrel spending has to stop. We are bankrupt. Now, there's another way to approach this problem. I'm getting political now. I went from Louie and the Crazy Monkey to this now. But you see, I grew up in another time. I saw things as they are. I say everyone likes to be blue collar and this and that, a Joe Sixpack. Well, I don't have to try to be thinking that way. Although I have the creds to be an intellectual if I choose to be and wipe the floor up with them, and I have the credentials to do it and the publications, I can wipe the floor up with any one of the bow tie wearing loafer guys. Trust me on that. I don't even think they wear loafers anymore, but we'll change the shoe for the times. I don't need to do that. I still think the way a working man thinks. It's as simple as that. If you can walk with kings and never lose the common touch, then you will be a man, my son. So if I can talk to the gardener in broken English and broken Spanish and get a laugh out of him, and he takes out his iPhone and shows me his brother boxing in Richmond, and I had no idea this gardener worked for me, and his younger brother's a gardener, was a boxer. It was such a pleasure for me to get into a boxing discussion. Because gardeners are tough. I mean, they work with their hands all day long. They're, you know, anyone who works with their hands is a strong man. Some of them can fight. These boys can fight. Their heart is iron. And he told me the story that one of the guys in the gym of another race, these are Latino kids, slammed an elbow into his face in the middle of a fight and broke his nose to try and stop him because he was too good and they didn't want him to move ahead in the gym. This is the kind of world they live in. And yet they can come and plant gardenias for me and be pleasant enough about it all. And if I can talk to them in a broken language, believe me, I can talk to my audience in a whole language. So I know what's going on. You know what's going on. Unfortunately, the Republicans, they're not weak. They're not evil. You shouldn't really call them names. I mean, I've called them Republicrats as far as I would go. What's the point? What are you going to gain by it? They're decent men. They're not used to dealing with gangsters. They're not used to negotiating against Al Capone. That's all it comes down to. And so the Tea Party representatives in the Republican Party are, in essence, the backbone of the Republican Party. They're the backbone. They are the backbone. They're the muscle. They're the muscle of the Republican Party, and that's the fight. And as we draw to a conclusion in this hour, I invite you to call me at 855-400-7282 on any of the topics we've been talking about. And I intend to, at the turn of the hour, 34 in the next hour, tell your friends, do another family story for the holidays, even though we're not in the holidays. All of this on the Savage Nation, where we will go into the biggest shakeup in radio and talk radio history come January. And let the chips fall where they may, because as far as I'm concerned, I already won. It's not even a fight anymore. I already won the fight. It's like opening a bar in San Francisco. It's not a matter of how much money it'll make. Say, will it make money? They used to say, well, it's not a matter of will it make money. It's a matter of how much money it will make. That's the story. More when I return right here on the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage. Warning, the Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. And here he is, Michael Savage.
Why have you not been able to create a bipartisan atmosphere here? And do you take any of the blame on yourself for that?
Well, you know, I think that if you look at my track record over the last 4 years, I have consistently sought compromise, sometimes to the point where Democrats have been mad at me, but I didn't care because I did what I thought was best for the country.
We're disappointed that the House Republicans decided to sabotage or at least delay what was happening there, but are hopeful that everybody knows the time is of the essence, and that if the Republicans in the House want to put up a bill, they should do it soon. But they have to know if it is as it has been described, that they'll have to do that with 100% Republican vote.
St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
See, that's the age I grew up in, where you worked for a living, you paid your taxes, and you died. It's that simple. Now you got people, they don't work for a living, they pay no taxes. They're living off the welfare state. And we're going bankrupt, we're broke. So you got one party that's feeding the welfare bums, because they buy votes that way and they get kickbacks and bribes, whatever. You know, you can't prove it. They're too smart for that. In meetings in bathrooms on interstate highways and bags that go to bag men and bag ladies. You never. You know, offshore accounts, onshore accounts, her account, his account, my account. There's no accounting for their accounts. And they love it. They've never had it so good. This Obamacare is the greatest scandal in the history of America. The greatest grift. This makes the Sopranos sporting goods store racket look like what it is, a television fable. The amount of money that will be stolen under Obamacare cannot even be counted. It can't even be imagined. It's unfathomable. Between the fake ambulance rides, the fake prescriptions, the fake analysis, you name it, it will be the greatest scandal in history. The country is bankrupt now. We'll never recover from socialized medicine. Never. And all controlled by who? Well, now you got the other party who have been outmaneuvered by the media and by the silver-tongued Obama and such. The other party simply saying, please rein in the pork barrel spending, but they haven't been able to articulate it. It's that simple. And that is why I have been, instead of talking about this ad infinitum, behind this blur and flurry of insanity, I've been doing readings from Train Tracks, my new paperback. I mean, I could talk about the hatred going on coming out of the Democrat Party, and you can see where the hatred comes from. The hate talk is coming from Barbara Boxer, comparing it to spousal abuse. The hate talk is coming from Nancy Pelosi, talking about things you can't believe. It's all hate talk. They're the most hateful people on the planet. And you have the Republicans. They're basically nice guys, most of them. In the mainstream regular Republicans, they're decent men. They want to get along. They want to go along. They want to do a deal. And what they've gotten in return is, you know what? We got you over a barrel, and we're not going to stop rolling you because we're enjoying the sport of hurting you. They don't know what to do. The other party is vicious. They're malicious. It's very much like dealing with litigators from, let's say, Brooklyn. Boys who went to NYU Law, whose father was, let's say, smaller than them. They went to law school, some good Ivy League law schools, because they were smart memorizers and vicious. They hated everybody. And the father and mother were vicious communists who told them to get even with the world and don't take anything from anybody and blah, blah, blah. And the kid goes to law school and he becomes a vicious, like a Mad Hatter litigator. And there's no right, there's no wrong, there's no good, there's no bad. It's win at all costs. They'll burn the house down rather than give up a nickel. And the Republicans don't have that type of legal mind behind them. There's no litigation expertise in the Republican side. They're dealing with the most rapacious New York, Chicago litigators the world has ever seen. To the detriment, by the way, of the American people. There's one thing to win at all costs, and winning is the only thing. I get that. But at a certain point, you can take all the winnings off the table. And then what do you have? You have all the winnings, and then what? There's no game left. Where are you going to go for your next game? Who are you going to put over the table? Why don't they use some of that tough mentality that they have, I ask myself, on the Taliban or on the Iranians? How come they're so soft when it comes to Iran? How come they don't talk so tough when it comes to Iran? Why do they talk so tough to the nice Republicans and walk so meekly in front of the Iranians or Hezbollah? Why is that? Why? Because they're cowards. They're vicious cowards. And the Republicans are fundamentally not weak and call them any name under the sun. They're nicer men. They're decent men. Maybe they're not even men for our time anymore. Maybe that's as simple as that. And behind the Republicans, you have the Tea Party. And I just drank a cup of tea in their honor. Delicious tea, by the way. Plain old Earl Grey. That's my Tea Party I have every night on the show. I have a cup of Earl Grey tea, and I enjoy it very much because it's soothing. See, that's my homage to the Tea Party, is a cup of tea at every show. And that's the battle. But unfortunately, the Republicans have not articulated the fact that they're simply trying to range in pork barrel spending. And that's it. And that's the whole story. And they shouldn't give in. There's another position the Republicans could take, by the way, which is defaulting on our national debt. Why can't we just not pay the Chinese? After all, they didn't earn all of the money, honestly. I mean, think about this. You know, no one's ever said it. Argentina's defaulted how many times now? There still is Argentina. Buenos Aires is a beautiful city. The Argentinians have the tango. The Argentinians have the pampas. The Argentinians still have a country. Somehow they defaulted, and we still do business with them. My father was an honest businessman, but he told me that there were men who were not so honest. And he used to tell me about them. Again, I'll go back to what I learned. He would say they were a little bigger than him in business, by the way. He would tell me, he said, did you hear what Abe did? The other guy owned the bigger store. I said, no. He went bankrupt. I said, oh, that's terrible. He's going to be in the street. He's going to be wearing a dead man's pants. His children won't eat. He said, no, he said. He declared bankruptcy. He said, Chapter 11. And he said, the people that he said he couldn't pay are still anxious to do business with him. I said, what? And he would smile. He said, yeah. He said, that's how the system works. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, the people who he said he cannot pay are lining up around the corner to still do business with him because they want to do business with him in order to stay in business themselves. They have to do business with him. I said, what do you mean? He just wipes out the money he owes them? He said, yes. And they're anxious to do business with him. So he said, every few years, Abe goes bankrupt. And they continued to do business with him, and Abe kept getting fatter and richer. Now, my father didn't work in that realm of business. He never declared bankruptcy. He paid his bills on time. He wrote whatever. Everything was balanced with him. He never bought anything on time. In those days, he thought you were cheating if you bought a car on credit. Would you believe it? Like, if a neighbor bought a bigger car than he had, he would say, I'll bet he bought it on time. He's cheating. See, he figured you pay for what you can afford, and that's the way he lived, and that's how I was brought up. Now, I'm not saying we should pay for what we can afford, because most of us would be in the poorhouse if that's all we could afford. We wouldn't even be driving cars. We'd be sitting on a mule if we could afford that. I understand the credit system. It's actually quite brilliant. But what we have here is a unique situation. And I say we should consider bankruptcy, defaulting on the debt. Because I can guarantee you, as I stand here, the countries that have outmaneuvered us because they bought off the politicians who are now bankrupting us, by trading against us with currencies that were valued too low, by not paying proper duties on imports, by rigging the system, by flooding America with junk products to drive our own manufacturers out of business, I say default on their debt. And I can guarantee you they'll be in line to do business with us the next day. Just a thought from an American talk show host. What do you think of that idea? Should we default on our debt? I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
Okay, let me give you my position all over again on defaulting on our debt obligations, because no one's talking about it. They're saying if the U.S. defaults or reneges on its debt obligations, the sky will fall, and they're saying that if we renege on our debt obligations, it would make the U.S. the first major Western government to default since Nazi Germany 80 years ago. You may not know this, but Germany unilaterally ceased payments on long-term borrowings on May 6, 1933, 3 months after Hitler was installed as chancellor. And he did so because Germany was strapped with reparations that were crippling the German economy. So he said to them, go to hell, I'm not paying them. Now, I would argue that most of our debt, or a good portion of the debt of the United States of America today, is based upon reparations. The reparations are in the form of obscene payments for government programs that we cannot afford, that we never could afford, that were reparations because of pressures put upon the taxpayers by the radical left in this country. Whether those reparations are in the form of obscene welfare payments or of what they call, I forget the other so-called benefits that the leech class gets, they are reparations. And I don't owe anybody Jack Johnson, let me tell you that. I've worked every day since I'm 5 years old. I am the son of an immigrant. I never stole anything from anybody. I never took anything that wasn't mine. I've paid my fair share of taxes. I follow the law, and I'm sick of it. And I don't want to pay any more reparations. That's one side of the debt. The other side of the debt is the Chinese, who outmaneuvered us by buying our politicians for the last 30 years, by devaluing the yuan. Remember that was a hot issue 10 years ago? And there was talk that we'd force them to revalue their currency? Well, where'd that go? Went nowhere. They smeared off enough of these superb leaders of ours that no one ever talked about making them revalue the yuan. They were burying us with their currency manipulations. And they are burying us by dumping garbage on our shores without any, what is it called, Michael? The dirty word to the Wall Street Journal, tariffs. We have the obligation to install tariffs on foreign goods. That would do several important things immediately, but we haven't done it, have we? So as a result of having been outmaneuvered by the Chinese and some other countries, we have this debt that we can't support. Now they're saying, you better not default. The sky will fall. I would argue the opposite. I would argue we should default on our debt. And I would say that they'd be around the block wanting to do business with us all over again the next second, because they got nowhere else to sell their goods and services. We are still the biggest market on the planet. They need us. There's nowhere else for them to go. And so, yeah, we could default on the debt. So what? A few of the greed bags on Wall Street would lose money on some of their speculative positions. A few of the currency traders who've been betting against the U.S. dollar would suddenly go bankrupt and have to take their daughters out of the Ivy League schools that they bought to put them in. These are generally catastrophic economic events, said Professor Eugene N. White, an economics historian at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. There is no happy ending. I would disagree with the professor. I would disagree. He says failure by the world's biggest economy to pay its debt in an interconnected, globalized world risks an array of devastating consequences that could lay waste to stock markets, again, Wall Street, from Brazil to Zurich, and bring the $5 trillion market in treasury-backed loans to a halt. Oh, treasury-backed loans to a halt? Borrowing costs would soar. Really? Well, they should soar, because then people with money in banks would earn interest. So I'd argue that the professor is wrong. He then says the dollar's role as the world's reserve currency would be in doubt. Would it be in doubt? First of all, the dollar would go up in value by about 100%. That's number one. And I'll tell you something else. The dollar's role as the world's reserve currency would not be in doubt. It would go up. Then he says the U.S. and world economies would risk plunging into recession and potentially depression. We are already in recession. They're just juggling the books. So now, while the Senate leaders of both parties are negotiating to avert a U.S. default, I would say they should consider the option, the Armageddon option of defaulting. If that's what it takes to balance the books, if that's what it takes to get the welfare leeches off my back, if that's what it takes to put some sanity into the Washington class of drunken sailors, and I don't think that they're like drunken sailors, they're worse than drunken sailors. If that's what it takes to Sopranos' takeover of my economy, then I say let it default. Now, if you are an economist or someone who knows economics and think that I am wrong, tell me why I'm wrong. Tell me who would let us say, be punished by a default. Is there anyone out there who knows why I am saying we should consider defaulting on our debt? They bring up Nazism. Every time someone wants to tighten their belt, they wheel out the professors from universities who tell us that U.S. may join Germany of 1933 in pantheon of defaults, and right away there they go with Hitler. Day one. Hitler, Hitler, Hitler. Hitler, Hitler, Hitler. If you default, there's going to be a Nazi come into power. Well, I would argue that we have the antithesis of a Nazi in power, which is a radical communist. By any means, I don't know. What, do you have to be a genius to see what he's doing? Every act. What you don't understand is that a communist doesn't have to be evil, look evil, talk evil, walk evil. Communists can be very intelligent, very pleasant, could have a nice family. Communists can dress nicely, play basketball, eat lean. A communist can be just like you and I. But he can still be a communist trying to impose upon America a system that is alien to it. Alien to it. You don't understand what that means, do you? Because you don't quite get what's going on and what's gone on. We've had a revolution in America, and what they're doing now is trying to put the last stake into the heart of the bull and bring it to its knees and destroy the bull. Bring down the bull of America. Put a stake in the eagle's eye. Bring the eagle out of the sky. Or something along those lines, not to be too poorly poetic. After all, I'm not the Reverend Jackson at all. No, sorry, Bob. Does anyone agree with me that should we consider going bankrupt to ruin Obama's legacy? I don't care about ruining Obama's legacy. That's not why I'm suggesting it. I am not suggesting that we do not pay our creditors at all in order to ruin Obama's legacy. It has nothing to do with Obama. I am saying we should consider not borrowing anymore to pay our creditors and defaulting on the payments, because the reparations have gotten out of hand in America. We cannot afford the reparations called benefits, social services. Those are reparations. Those are reparations by other names. And we can no longer afford these punitive reparations that have been foisted upon the working class. Agree or disagree? It's the Savage Nation. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282.
It is the Savage Nation. I realize that what I said tonight is provocative, and it's meant to be, but it's also to be considered because it's not off the table. And I'm saying default on our debt. We can't have a sovereign default, because what happens is, you have to look at history to see what happens. Germany and France both defaulted eight times since 1800. by the way. And the U.S. even failed to honor its obligations to the letter, I'm reading. In 1979, the United States was late making payments on about $122 million of bills. You hear? That's what Obama spends on one vacation. Blaming technical difficulties that the Treasury said stemmed from a failure in word processing equipment. In 1935, the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government was within its rights to reject claims for payment in gold on bonds that gave holders the option to demand the metal. Why? Well, because the terms of the contract were not fully honored. Some would argue that was tantamount to a default. Going back in time, in 1790, the U.S. deferred interest payments on debt assumed by the new federal government until 1801. What about Argentina and Greece? Serial defaulters Argentina and Greece have retained political, if not economic, independence, and they have defaulted. Argentina failed to meet its commitments five times since 1951, and in 2001, Argentina gained the record for the largest ever restructuring. Did you know that? But that was beaten by Greece in 2012. Argentina's still there. Greece is still there. Including 2012, Greece has defaulted six times since 1826. So Russia itself has restructured. Russia halted payments on $40 billion of local debt in 1998. Do you know why? Because oil, its main export at the time, plunged 42% amid a global economic slowdown triggered by the Asian financial crisis. And by the time it devalued the ruble and defaulted that August, the government of Russia had drained about half its foreign reserves and made an unsuccessful bid to increase the $22 billion international aid package it had received. But then Russia restructured its debt. Russia restructured its debt. Argentina restructured its debt. Greece restructured its debt. What does that mean? It means they work out a deal with their lenders and they pay back a certain amount of money on the dollar, 10 cents on the dollar, a quarter on the dollar. So who loses on that? The dollar goes through the ceiling, interest rates go up, people who have money in the banks suddenly are making money again on their interest. Borrowing becomes harder, yes. So what? Why should everyone in America be spending on things they can't afford? Where is it written that people have to have five cars and three vacations or four vacations a year? Where is it written that they have to have all of that gaudy jewelry? Where is it written that they must have these expensive things? Where is it written that that's the way we should live? I wasn't raised to live that way. If you can afford it, buy it. Good luck to you. But if you can't afford it, don't buy it with funny money because someone's going to pay for it anyway. So the banks oppose this, obviously. Wall Street opposes it, obviously. The Democrat government opposes it, obviously. But it doesn't mean that it can't be done. And I'm saying the U.S. situation today is pretty dire, but there's no reason we can't take option C. We have a president who is unwilling to negotiate. Be very clear about it. The Republicans have come on their hands and knees and said, please, please take us for a ride. We can't fight with you. You're too tough for us. The litigators from Chicago, I'm being nice now. The litigators from Chicago and New York's worst law schools, the lowest of the low are running the Obama administration, people without a shred of decency. They grew up in the school of winning is the only thing, and they will do anything they have to win, as any litigator will do who has no conscience. And win they are. They're winning right now because the Republicans have not articulated the fact that all they want to do is stop the pork barrel spending and spell it out for the average person. I don't think they made that point. So there's a third option, which is a default on the debt. And if there's an intelligent caller out there, thus far I don't have one, who knows what I'm talking about and could debate this issue and tell me why I'm wrong without screaming, without yelling, I invite you to call me on why default is a bad idea at 855-407-282. But please don't call and say we should default to show Obama's not in control. I don't need that kind of caller. I need a discussion. Should we default on our debt? And if we shouldn't default, tell me why, what will happen. Now, while you're calling me at 855-407-282, remember that you're talking to a talk show host that right now is on in the Siberia of radio. I took the Siberia time slot for a year now. It'll be a year this October 22nd that I've been in this time slot. Actually, I started in November, I think, just before the election. It'll be a 1 year. But come January, I go into the mainstream. I go into drive time on the East Coast and all the big stations in the country, 200 stations by count right now. And my signature will be not only my insights and my education, my ability to back my points of view with the facts, but also some of my stories. Everyone loves the storytelling. And once this debate of the debt is over. We'll have to go back to regular programming. I know people have been going on and on about this. We won't have anything left to say, but I will have plenty to say. So I want to play a one-minute piece for you now from Train Tracks, my paperback book. And it's what I've seen in my lifetime. Let's play it.
Times in my life. You won't believe this. And here they are. Look what I have seen in my lifetime. I want to show you how long I've been around this planet so you're going to get a feeling of what I've seen in my lifetime. One, Superman defeated by every man in World War II. Two, the first atomic bomb used in warfare. The establishment of the State of Israel. The popularization of television. This is all in my lifetime. The popularization of air conditioning. The popularization of air travel. The popularization of the personal computer. The invention of the internet. The assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King Jr. I've seen the complete integration of blacks and whites. I've seen the development of mass welfare for unproductive citizens. I've seen the destruction of America's judicial system by corrupt lawyers. I've seen the meltdown of America's borders. I've seen the self-genocide of America's European-American majority through a mass abortion, a mass tolerance of diverse sexualities. I've seen the acceptance of narcotics. I've seen the debasement of religion. I've seen the takeover of corporations by gamblers and con men. I've seen the elimination of grades in many schools. I've seen the introduction of racial quota systems. I've seen the impeachment of a president. What will I see in the future? Well, that's for you to decide, not me.
Savage. All right, so I'm an American, period. And that's what I've lived through. Those are some of the broad strokes of my view of the world. And now I actually could add to that and say, I've seen the first ascent of a socialist to the White House, because there's no question that that's what's happened. And we don't even understand it because of the socialists in the media who won't even express reality to you, let alone will not stop debasing you if you dare say what's obvious to anyone who studied history. Everything I was warned would happen to America when a foreign government took over this country is happening under Obama. I want you to think about that. Everything that men older than me fought for in World War II to stop from happening in this country is happening in this country right now, which is why the man closed down the World War II Veterans Memorial, which is why the man who hates the military closed down the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, because the women around them hate the military. They despise them. They spit on them. They call them names. And yet today he gave out a Medal of Honor. And that was, of course, because of the unpopularity and the fact that people finally saw through him. The people saw the people in the military who were basically loyal and devoted and good, some of whom have been hoodwinked into thinking of Democrats are their friends. They realized the poll numbers were in the garbage. The poll numbers amongst the Democrats were in the toilet. They were going to be thrown out in droves for what they did at those memorials. And so they got their front man out today, and they gave out a Medal of Honor to some poor guy today who did his heroic act in 2009, Teddy. That's what I'm trying to tell you. So it's the world according to Michael Savage. It's one man's opinion. Don't take it to the bank. It's what I believe to be true. If you don't believe it to be true, it's a free country. Tell me why I'm wrong about defaulting on our debt. Now, there's no one who's called me on that. Is there anyone who's arguing with this or taking my position? Okay, let's start with Max on KSFO Radio. I haven't taken too many calls tonight. But remember what I'm proposing, that we consider Armageddon, we consider defaulting. Yes or no? No one said this. You name one talk show host, I don't know of one, who said we should go to Plan C, which is default. They're into, oh, the Republicans are weak, they should fight, blah, blah, blah. Standard stuff. Two-card, two-dimensional thinking. There's a way to think three-dimensionally, just default. Do you think if we defaulted on our debt that China would suddenly stop doing business with us? Are you out of your mind? They'd be here immediately to do more business with us. We could probably agree to pay them a certain amount of the debt that we owe them. Get an economist who's somewhat conservative and knows what they did in the yuan and what they did in dumping on our shores and the amount of money they saved by not paying their fair share in tariffs. And figure it out and say, that's the amount of debt that we'll take off and the rest will pay you. They're intelligent people. They're very practical, pragmatic people. They won't go away. What are they going to do, business with Argentina and not us? What's the government shutdown? So what, 800,000 employees are not working? And what service are you not getting that you need? Someone to lick postage stamps for you? a government employee to come in and shine your shoes in the morning because you can't do it yourself because you have some kind of disease? What are you, crazy? How much can you expect from a government? And I don't want to pay for it anymore. Agree or disagree? Default now. Let's move on. Let's start in San Francisco. KSMO Max, is my idea crazy or not?
Hey, thanks, Mike. You know, I've been thinking this for a long time. I think we should default. I think it's kind of like the sooner we take this medicine, the sooner our country will get better. And I'll give you a quick analogy. It's kind of like a junkie, man. We are addicted to debt. Not we, but Washington is addicted to borrowing money, and they will lie, it will cheat, it will steal, it will do anything for its fix. I think it's going to be, it's going to take some strong medicine. And
but what I'm saying is, well, I'm asking the Max. Thank you for listening so intently. But I'm asking an economist to call the show, or a banker, or a lawyer who knows the ins and outs of default and what it would actually mean to our economy, and tell me why I'm wrong. Because remember, I have a great influence on a certain number of people, not the greatest influence for sure, not the largest audience, not in this time slot. I'm not a megalomaniac. I don't believe I have the largest audience. I know it's not true. But I have a very significant audience of people who think. And I drop the pebble in a quiet pond at night, and the ideas tend to go out in ripples across the country. People will talk about this, and they'll think about it. And I think that if you disagree with me strongly and you're afraid that this could be catastrophic for America, you should call me. My job is to be provocative. My job, like any good college teacher, is to say things that shock you into listening, reacting, and calling me and arguing with me. You don't have to call me names because I'll hang up on you. If you call me and you tell me why my idea is wrong, go ahead, I'll give you the floor. If you start cursing or being stupid, I'm not going to have a discussion with you. Hell is a place where there is no reason. I choose not to go to hell. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
I love you, dear, but, you know, I'm shutting down your entire government. I love you, dear, but I'm going to default and you're going to be weak. Something is dreadfully wrong.
Now, this is a psychotic. I mean, if I'm not a psychiatrist, but if I were a psychiatrist, I would say Barbara Boxer is exhibiting all the symptoms of psychosis, comparing this discussion to domestic abuse. I mean, this is quite telling. I don't want to know what goes on behind closed doors, and I don't mean in the Senate. But to compare this discussion to domestic abuse is so overtly obvious to any psychiatrist that isn't worth discussing. Let's go back to the proposal I've made this evening, that we consider Plan C, which is defaulting on our debt. And Jim in KSFO has an interesting comment to make, which I haven't heard yet. Maybe you want to hear it yourself. Jim on KSFO, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Michael, thanks for taking my call. I'm in financial research. I'm on the equity research side, not on the fixed income or the debt side. But certainly, you know, I philosophically agree that defaulting on the debt would cause a lot of questions to happen that we should probably be asking. But fundamentally, what would happen is that you would have a change in the demand and supply of treasuries, which is ultimately paid for in dollars, right? And you correctly mentioned that interest rates would go up because the demand for our debt would go down. But the tangential effect to that is that you would have an effect of the U.S. dollar relative to other foreign currencies, i.e. you would have dollar inflation because...
Right. The dollar would go way, way up, would it not?
The value of the dollar would go down relative to other currencies, i.e. if you had £1, you would be less willing to trade that £1 for $1.5. You'd say,
even though you're in financial, and I'm sure you know more than I do, my gut feeling tells me that we're not disconnected from the English pound, and even if the dollar was affected, which it would be, the pound would be affected just as well because they're not so disconnected from us anymore. And I'm referring to previous panics, like the Panic of 1873, which I'm sure you studied in university, correct?
Yes, and Michael, you are correct in the sense that because the dollar is the global reserve currency, there is a backstop to it, and people will have a fundamental demand for the dollar because we are the reserve currency. But
that's right. No matter what we did, they would still run to the dollar. So what would the effects be? The interest rates would go up. So people with money that's earning zero interest right now would suddenly start earning interest again, wouldn't they?
That is true, but
well, another effect. Actually, I'm taking your argument. Real estate values would probably. I don't think they would plummet, but the increases would not be too great. There'd be some stagnation in real estate prices, which I think is a good thing, because most of the real estate prices are out of control right now and not related to anything real. So I don't know that it's all such a bad thing. You know, it may just put some sanity back into financial markets, Jim.
That's true, but the other thing you have to also remember is that the purchasing power would change. Now, I believe we should be buying more domestically than internationally, but the fact of the matter is that we still source a lot of our goods and services.
Yes, and the sale of American goods overseas would be, U.S. goods would be more expensive overseas, and therefore our sales would diminish. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, what I'm saying is that foreign goods would become more expensive because you would have to pay more.
That's right, so we'd buy Fords instead of Volvos. What's wrong with that?
I don't fundamentally disagree with it, but I think that
we'd buy Cadillacs instead of Mercedes. What's wrong with that? So, you know, there's a benefit and a risk-benefit ratio here that no one's talking about, Jim, and I think someone needs to discuss this the way I'm trying to do it tonight. And I really believe that I'm not doing this just for... I really believe that I'm onto something, and I'm not just doing it for effect. I want you to believe that, and I thank you for the call. The Panic of 1873, if you do a quick study, was one of the first great depressions in Europe and the United States that lasted for about 6 years, 5 years. And what happened was the panic led to the Great Depression. And what led to it is you're not going to believe this. The Panic of 1873, which led to bank runs in New York and elsewhere, had several causes. And economic historians will tell you that the causes are not so dissimilar to what we are facing today. One, post-war inflation. We have post-war inflation under the surface in America that's been kept under control by Bernanke's money pumping. But we have inflation under the surface. Rampant speculative investments. You're telling me that Facebook stock is worth what Zuckerberg has made? Are you crazy? Rampant speculative investments. Then it was in railroads. Today it's in internet stocks, for example, such as Facebook. A large trade deficit. Does that ring a bell with you? A large trade deficit occurred at that time and led to this, etc. There are other factors that put great strains on the economy in 1873 that led to a crisis, that led to financial failure, that led to defaulting on our debt. And America recovered from it after that. It wasn't pleasant for everyone, but somehow it put a stop to insane spending by the government and by the people, and it straightened things out. It's like a disease. Do you understand that not all... This is something that's very hard for people to understand, but I learned it way back when I first went into the sciences of medical thinking, which is that not all diseases are bad for you. Some diseases are actually quite helpful. They help restore your health. A fever, for example. I learned very early on that if you're running a fever, let the fever burn. You don't put the fire out of your fever, because what the fever is doing is that your body trying to suppress through high temperature within some of the toxins or the microbes that are in your body. But they can't live in such high temperatures and they die off. The fever is self-limiting and you're healed. But if you suppress that fever at the first sign of it with aspirin or acetaminophen, what you're doing is suppressing your immune system and your immune response. And what you're doing is you're building a deeper disease like cancer. Well, my friends, we have financial cancer. And Obama is the worst damn doctor imaginable.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage. Warning. The Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. And here he is, Michael Savage.
Okay, you made it to the third hour of The Savage Nation this Tuesday night, October 15th. Wow, is the news terrible. Senator Boxer is being as abusive as ever, calling Republicans domestic abusers. Obama is being as devious and as hateful as ever, attacking Republicans more so than he attacks Al-Qaeda. The Senate Surrender Caucus is taking shape as the deal fights on. This is all on michaelsavage.com. If you'd like to see a picture of Teddy in his new 1970 convertible, you can see a picture of him under the headline, Savage Moving to Drive Time, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern. Teddy's going to be real happy. He can go to sleep earlier. Sebelius, Obamacare is going to bring Western civilization to its knees. It already has. Look what we have in the White House. And you know, evil lives on forever, by the way. A Nazi SS captain who organized the execution of 335 men and boys in Italy in World War II died in his sleep at age 100 with no remorse. It just shows you that, A, God may be asleep when it comes to pure evil, and B, purely evil people sleep well at night. How do you like that? You wouldn't have guessed it, would you? Meanwhile, I'm talking today also about ADHD, the drug pushers pushing it, the pharmaceutical medical establishment, who have medicalized traits that previous generations simply lived with in other ways. Fidgetiness is now ADHD. Drug the child for being bored out of his mind from chalk on a blackboard? Yep, the drug peddlers are worse than crack dealers. Meanwhile, your army has defined a Christian ministry as a domestic hate group. That's what's going on under Obama's communist revolution. Oh, I'm sorry, did I say communist revolution? Oh, I mean transformation. How about reading about Obamacare and the Edsel, A Tale of Two Lemons? Or that a Chinese developer is investing $5 billion in Brooklyn? Well, maybe the food will get better. A photo shows just one person at an Obamacare event. One person. Government set it up. One person? Wow. Cumulus announces Savage's move to Drive Time, The Rise of Savage, Michael Savage's Radio Renaissance, my new novel, Abuse of Power, and A Time for War. And I've been reading from Train Tracks, my family stories. You can get the Savage Nation free daily newsletter by clicking on the site on the left side. Meanwhile, at this late hour, it's all fallen apart. Conservatives and moderates are close to open revolt. Boehner didn't have the votes. It's unbelievable. It goes on and on and on. The Texas lieutenant governor is calling for the impeachment of Obama. Palin says defaulting on a national debt is an impeachable offense. What? 855-400-7282 is the phone number. MichaelSavage.com is the website. But I want to tell you about the budget debate, even though I didn't want to talk about the budget debate. It's about the budget, stupid. Here's what it comes down to in case you've been blindsided by Obama's silver tongue and Nancy Pelosi's vicious tongue and Barbara Boxer's demented tongue. When I was a kid in Jamaica High School, Queens, New York, we had history, civics, like everyone else, and we had review books where we would review for the Regents exams. And one of the topics that I remember, and I don't know whether it was Democrats or Republicans, it applied to the words pork barrel spending. And it stuck with me all these years. I remember, who remembered? It's a blur. I'm not pedantic. I never liked pedantic teachers. I don't like pedantic talk show hosts who wrap themselves in the Constitution every minute. They remind me of the Marxist professors I had posing as conservatives now. I don't like pedantry. I don't like pedantic discussions. But what stuck out from the review books in my high school class was a description of pork barrel spending. And what it is, if you look it up, is this. It's slang. A bill or project requiring considerable spending, considerable government spending, in a locality to the benefit of the legislators' constituents who live there. Let me repeat that. Government, politics, diplomacy, pork barrel spending. Slang, U.S. slang. A bill or project requiring considerable government spending in a locality to the benefit of the legislators' constituents who live there. The term originally applied to the federal treasury, considered as a source of lucrative grants. And I said to myself, wait a minute. If they had one articulate Republican instead of these stumble-bum, pink-tie-wearing drunks who get up and said, look, ladies and gentlemen, you're confused by Obama's tremendous skills as an orator. But don't be confused. He is the party of drunken spending. We are the party trying to rein in pork barrel spending. It's that simple. And if somebody had explained it to the American people, I can guarantee you the country would be in a better place today. And the Democrats would be on the defense, not on the offense. That's why I don't want to do too much politics. It's futile. It's why people are turning off radio, talk radio. They're listening to music. They're doing anything but listening to this gibberish, by and large. They can't take it. How much can you listen to this? I've said to you 1,000 times, and I'll say it again. Obama is the president. Boehner is the Speaker of the House. Are they the sun, the moon, and the stars? Are we primitives who are looking up at the sky? Do we not have a telescope to look beyond this constellation around the Earth? There are other galaxies out there other than Obama, Boehner, Cantor, Debbie Schultz, Harry Reid. They're like dormant planets, these people, to me. They're like planets without water. Each one of them is like a planet without life on it. How long can you look at a planet that is arid? How long can you look at a planet without water, without an atmosphere? That's what looking at Obama is like. That's what looking at these politicians is it like. How long can you gape at planets without water, without an atmosphere? I can't. It's enough to drive a sane man crazy. And I'm sane, and I'm not going to be driven crazy by them. Of course I'll tell you what the news is. Of course I will. Of course I will. And if I see a poignant point, as I did, that when Obama closed off the war memorials, the vets, because he's the most divisive, vindictive president in American history, when he closed off the war memorials to the World War II vets and the Vietnam vets, he not only exhibited his true self, but he violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. I don't know why that was not picked up on, other than I'm ignored and hated by everyone in the media because I'm a little more incisive than they would like. Let's put it that way. When January comes around, and God willing, I'm in drive time on the monster real estate that Cumulus owns across America, they're going to have to pay attention to me. And I will tell you that my insights will be approximately as they are now. This is Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
Politics is not theology. It's work. And the framers of the Constitution gave us a system that was supposed to produce honorable compromise after honest debate. Because nobody's got this right all the time. And the more complex problems are, the more you need people to work together.
You know, it almost sounds as though Bill Clinton is trying to tell Obama to stop being so rigid and inflexible. Remember, Bill Clinton was a master politician. Let's stop already with the cigars and the screwing around. He was a master politician. He was a compromiser. And by comparison, you would almost say Bill Clinton was somewhat not of a he was a centrist compared to this guy. You got to understand, Obama is out of the ken of normal politics. Obama is a far left radical who was completely out of the ken of not only of politics, but he's never been seen at a national level in the country's history ever. And Bill Clinton knows this. And Bill Clinton understands the danger his own party is in for being uncompromising. That's what I read from that. That's how I see it. Maybe you see it differently. 855-400-7282. I'm sitting here. It's nice. It's 10:15, 2013. You are hearing a spoon in a teacup. That must be a pleasant sound on radio, to hear a host stirring his tea early. The dog even like dogs. Imagine the dog sleeping on the mic table. I saw an article today on ADHD amongst women. I had to say, I got so furious because they're peddling drugs to poor women. It was in some website that pushes drugs under the guise of health. And it says, common symptoms of ADD and ADHD in women. And I said, oh my God, difficulty with boring repetitive tasks, spending time ruminating. Difficulty making decisions such as skim 1%, 2% of homework. Difficulty sitting still. Difficulty falling asleep and waking up the next morning. Poor sense of time. Starting projects but seeming unable to finish them. Taking on too much. Engaging in addictive behaviors like shopping. Feeling low self-worth. Hypersensitivity to criticism. I said, do they have no shame, these drug peddlers? These are not real symptoms. These are human emotions, the human reactions. And the drug peddlers, called the pharma's big pharma, in cahoots with Big Med, have no limit to how far they want to go in peddling their drugs. I mean, by this definition, my dog Teddy has PDHD, poodle deficit hyperactivity disorder. I could apply these symptoms to my dog Teddy. I thought about it today on his walk. PDHD, poodle deficit hyperactivity disorder. Maybe they should prescribe medication for him. One, difficulty with boring repetitive tasks, Absolutely, check yes. Spending time ruminating. What do you think he's doing sleeping so much? 3, difficulty making decisions. Which bush shall he pee on? 4, difficulty sitting still. He never sits. He fidgets. 5, difficulty falling asleep and waking up the next morning. He does. He likes to play at night. 6, poor sense of time. He has no sense of time. He thinks he's immortal. He never thinks about death. Here's one, starting projects but seeming unable to finish them. That's Teddy to a T. I haven't seen him finish one model airplane since I bought him. You get the picture. You get the picture. They're trying to make poor women think that they have an illness to peddle drugs to them. You get it? Maybe I should tell you happy and sad cufflinks when I was in the sixth grade. And I would tell you right now that if I was in a grade school today in the sixth grade, they put me on every mind-controlling drug imaginable. ADHD is nothing compared to what they say I have. The mean-faced, clipped-haired women would say, that little savage, he has shining eyes and he talks too much. Put him on Ritalin. Put him on Adderall. Put him on Prozac. Put him in a straitjacket. He shows all the classic signs of being a boy. We must kill it. We must suppress it. We must crush it. Crush it. Crush it, I say. Drug it. Drug that maleness. I believe most mothers don't even know what their poor boys go through in school today. And when I was a young boy, my mother bought me a pair of cufflinks. They were a set of the thespian masks. You know, one was a sad face and one was a happy face. I love those cufflinks. I'd look at them when I was bored in class. On my right cuff, I had the happy face. On the left sleeve, I had the sad face. Some days I switched them around and put the happy face on the left sleeve and the sad face on the right sleeve. Many days I was so bored out of my mind, I didn't know what to do. I'd look at these cufflinks for hours in the classroom while the teacher was going on and on about George Washington, the Delaware River, the Constitution. I was so bored I spaced out. I learned that George crossed the Delaware. He saved the country in Trenton. He overthrew the British. I got that in kindergarten. They're still teaching it to me in the fourth grade. In the fifth grade, I learned what a peninsula is. In the sixth grade, it took them a year to teach me what an island is. I couldn't take it. So I stared at the cufflinks, the happy face, the sad face. When I got bored with the cufflinks, I start pulling hair out of the skin of my arms. Today, they would have put me on Ritalin or put me in a bug house. They call my lack of attention a disease. It wasn't. It was called boredom, boys and girls. I'd inflict pain on myself by pulling hairs out of my arm rather than listen to the boring teacher bore me one more second talking about the Constitution. Rather than improve the curriculum or place bright kids in special classes, teacher today might say, oh, your son has something wrong with him, Mrs. Savage. We found out that he looks at cufflinks instead of listening to the teacher talk about how evil America is and why white males need to be put in the pillory. He's pulling hair out of his arm, and we suggest you put him on a moderate dose, just a moderate starter dose of Adderall. That's for starters. Soon the teacher might say, let's put him on Prozac. Now, I'd be the first to admit that teaching is a tough profession. Keeping the lesson engaging day after day takes everything out of you. As long as I live, I'll never forget the day I first walked into a classroom to teach. Maybe I'll write a book about it one day. You know, something for the students. I would call it The Savage Guide to Surviving Teaching. Anyway, back then, I didn't look much older than the students. I graduated high school at 16, which means I, in turn, graduated college very young. Frankly, I decided to grow a goatee to look older than the junior high school kids in my first class. I remember when I raised my foot to walk over the curb that first day, to step into that junior high school, and my foot froze up. I actually stopped mid-stride. The students were racing past me to get to class, and I was standing there as stiff as a statue. I had no idea I had fear of teaching, but I did. If you think teaching is an easy job, try it someday. It is probably one of the toughest jobs on earth if you do it right. So when I'm critical about the teaching profession and the teachers' union, don't get me wrong, I fully recognize it's a tough drill. At the same time, there's no excuse for boring students to death. If an uneducated man like Woodchuck Bill could teach me about life, then surely I should be able to do the same with my college degree. At least that was my view as a beginning teacher. That's Happy and Sad Cufflinks from my paperback book, Train Tracks. I'm getting political now. But you see, I grew up in another time. I saw things as they are. I say everyone likes to be blue collar and this and that, a Joe Sixpack. Well, I don't have to try to be thinking that way. Although I have the creds to be an intellectual if I choose to be and wipe the floor up with them, and I have the credentials to do it and the publications, I can wipe the floor up with any one of the bow tie wearing loafer guys. Trust me on that. I don't even think they wear loafers anymore, but we'll change the shoe for the times. I don't need to do that. I still think the way a working man thinks. It's as simple as that. If you can walk with kings and never lose the common touch, then you will be a man, my son. So if I can talk to the gardener in broken English and broken Spanish and get a laugh out of him, and he takes out his iPhone and shows me his brother boxing in Richmond, and I had no idea this gardener worked for me, and his younger brother's a gardener, was a boxer. It was such a pleasure for me to get into a boxing discussion. Because gardeners are tough. I mean, they work with their hands all day long. They're, you know, anyone who works with their hands is a strong man. Some of them can fight. These boys can fight. Their heart is iron. And he told me the story that one of the guys in the gym of another race, these are Latino kids, slammed an elbow into his face in the middle of a fight and broke his nose to try and stop him because he was too good and they didn't want him to move ahead in the gym. This is the kind of world they live in. And yet they can come and plant gardenias for me and be pleasant enough about it all. And if I can talk to them in a broken language, believe me, I can talk to my audience in a whole language. So I know what's going on. You know what's going on. Unfortunately, the Republicans, they're not weak. They're not evil. You shouldn't really call them names. I mean, I've called them Republicrats as far as I would go. What's the point? What are you going to gain by it? They're decent men. They're not used to dealing with gangsters. They're not used to negotiating against Al Capone. That's all it comes down to. And so the Tea Party representatives in the Republican Party are, in essence, the backbone of the Republican Party. They're the backbone. They are the backbone. They're the muscle. They're the muscle of the Republican Party, and that's the fight. I invite you to call me at 855-400-7282 on any of the topics we've been talking about. It really is a long day's journey into tonight, and you got to be made out of some strong protoplasm to do what I do. After all these years, I'm still doing it with vigor. Why? Because I love it.
Savage.
What else is in the news? Well, there are some other news stories. I'm not ready to jump yet, nor am I ready for the golden oldies. So here are some questions for the Savage Nation. Today, a Medal of Honor winner asked to return to duty. And if you watch the ceremony of the cynical Obama pinning the Medal of Honor on William D. Swenson, you saw several things. You saw the most cynical president in American history, a man who grew up hating America's military, a man who grew up hating the police, a man who hates guns, hates bullets, hates ammunition. And why did he suddenly give a Medal of Honor to this hero? The man committed his life to save his fellow troops during a battle against the Taliban in 2009. He risked his life to help save his comrades, simply to retrieve the bodies of four Americans who were killed during the seven-hour battle on September 8, 2009. He is the first Army officer to receive the U.S. military's highest valor award since the Vietnam War. Why would this military-hating president of ours give him the Medal of Honor today? It's quite simple. Look at what Obama did last week. He closed the Vietnam and World War II memorials to veterans. He violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. He violated the codes which say that you have to have handicap access. He committed elder abuse against World War II veterans. It created such an outcry that even his minions who hate the military said, uh-oh, Barry, you better do something quick to regain a few of those military votes. What can we do? So the girls who advise him, the four horsewomen of the apocalypse, said, I don't know, get one of them out here and give him a medal. What medal? I don't know, get one of them out. Get him out here. Who? Get one of them out here. One of the idiots who went in there. One of the idiots who shoot the guns in Afghanistan. Give them some kind of award that everyone will notice you're the commander-in-chief again. Get some of them out here. And they did research, and they got a real hero, and they gave him an award. It was the most cynical granting of a Medal of Honor I've ever seen in my entire life. That's why it happened today. And that's why I'm telling it to you. We're living in the most cynical times of all. It's not pleasant to look at these things, but you have to do it. Someone has to do it. And I ask myself every morning as I prepare for the show beginning at 6:30 in the morning, every morning like clockwork, the sun comes up even though I have blackout curtains. I'm on a diurnal cycle like every other mammal. And the minute that light peers through the curtain, no matter what, and a little bit of the beer from the night, you know, the bladder, I don't want to get into details. I'll make it classy. I'm on a diurnal cycle the minute the sun peers through the curtain. I get up and stretch, and I do 500 push-ups, and I brush my teeth with Colgate. No, I don't. I get up, and I stumble into the thing is, I get up at 6:30 every morning, And within a few seconds, I'm on the internet looking at what the damn Democrats have done to destroy my country and what they've done to steal from my paycheck again. And then I go and I have the coffee, etc. And it's such a long day's journey into night till I get on the air. 6 o'clock Pacific, 9 o'clock Eastern. What would I be doing if I were not here in front of this microphone right now? I would probably be in North Beach in San Francisco, probably going into a cafe filled with psychotic communist liberals who have not worked a day in their life, who are on crazy checks, SDSI. I know some of them. They sell a little pot on the side. God knows they have scams going. They don't make a lot of money. And they collect crazy checks, and they buy themselves every afternoon wine and beer and coffee. And they spit on America. They spit on the flags of the fallen. They sit with such hatred, and I say to myself, God save me from that. Or else that's where I'd probably be, in the club where anyone is welcome, because nobody is anything. I'd be sitting like a sconce in a window, asking myself what I did wrong to wind up in this cafe talking to these American-hating communist losers on SDSI crazy checks. So I thank God that I had the votes to get this position, unlike John Boehner. I thank God that the tea is whistling in the background, Teddy is snoozing underneath the desk. And I thank God that God pulled me up, pulled me out, and put me in front of the microphone. The phone number here is 855-407-2822. I am talking about the simple division between the Democrats who are engaging in psychotic pork barrel spending, some of the Republicans and all of the Tea Party members who are simply trying to stop the pork barrel spending. And now, without further ado on the Savage Nation, as promised, we were going to play for you some Savage Golden Oldies. Hold on. Roll the drums. I got to build up to this because these stories are my favorites. It'll be what I'm remembered for, my vivid storytelling. Michael Savage is one of the most influential conservative voices in America, says the Washington Times. Washington Post says Savage recalls his childhood growing up in the Bronx. He's got the knack for evocative detail, features some indelible images, says the Washington Post. And these stories are all in my just-released paperback book, Train Track. So let's listen to which one, guys. What are we playing for the audience tonight? I don't know about Love by the Sewer Plant. That's not, I don't think. How about Louie and the Monkey, a favorite.
Louie and the Monkey story, which I told once at most in my tenure on radio. We go back now, ladies and gentlemen. Put on your resting cap. We're going to go back in time. We're going back to the Lower East Side of New York. Dad owns a small antiques mart. Little old Michael's cleaning bronzes in the back, and there's Louis the bum from the Bowery, who in those days, he was a drunk. He wasn't a bum. He worked. Dad would have him in on the weekends, and he'd clean the bronzes and whatever he did down there. I loved Louis. Louis was a great guy. But now you got to understand, this guy was a stoned alcoholic of the old school. Skinny like a rail. White guy, skinny like a rail, smoked like unfiltered cigarettes, but one of the nicest guys on earth. He wears the rubber apron. He's cleaning downstairs. Does the bronzes, then of course I took over because Dad wanted cheap child labor, and where else are you going to get it from his son, you know? So I'm doing the thing. So I got to know Louis over the years, and he taught me various things. Like once we had Louis over to the house, I'll never forget it. I was so proud that my father took this guy who I liked all the way out to Queens and invited him to dinner. I don't know what came over. Maybe it was Thanksgiving or whatever. And Louis had dinner with us at the table, and the guy was surprisingly erudite, and he knew things. And like after dinner, we did games, and Louis the drunk showed me how to bend nails. He showed me mind over matter. He took a nail and he showed me that if you put your fingers, blah, 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 and put your mind on it and keep up the pressure, the nail would bend. I was shocked because I was a skinny kid with little hands, and I bent the nail. And he taught me mind over matter, but it was all molecular because you put the heat and the pressure, blah, 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 eventually that nail is going to bend. But I learned in life it's the same thing. It's all willpower, okay? Now there's another element to the story. So Louis is this kind of guy, interesting, but an alcoholic, and this and that. Years go by. He lives alone in Williamsburg. In those days, Williamsburg was like a slum, zero, you know, oilcloth city, leftover apartments from the last century. No one wanted to be there but the poor. So he lives there alone. He's very lonely. He gets a monkey. He wants a monkey. Now, out of the world, nobody in those days had a monkey. Dogs, yes. Cats, yes. No. Who had a monkey in those days? Louis gets a monkey. But Louis don't just get a spider monkey, one of the skinny little monkeys. Louis gets a woolly monkey. Now, woolly monkeys are already strong. They got a chest on them. They got strong hands. And Louis's in love with this monkey. For a couple of months, they're inseparable. Wherever he goes, there's the monkey, and the monkey's on his shoulder, and where he's cleaning, and he's happy. Now, Louis was the kind of guy that if he went to a bar on the Lower East Side, I remember the name to this day, named Hamill and Corn, whatever money he made for my father, he'd take 2 minutes later, he'd be in the bar, and he'd throw money in a jukebox, and he would whistle and sing, and he'd buy everyone drinks till he was broke. He'd stumble out in the street, he would get hit by a car, sleep on a barrel, he didn't care, live for the booze, and that was it, but he had a heart of gold. So Louis gets the monkey, finally has someone to fill his empty nights, and as I say, they were inseparable. Well, as time went on, we get a call, Louis's in the hospital, he's dying. What? The monkey went crazy in his apartment, attacked him, and almost ripped him to pieces. And he suffered for 6 months in the hospital, I don't know which hospital, probably Bellevue, because that's where they all wound up. And the monkey went at him, and look, you don't know what a monkey's like when it goes crazy. You try to stop an enraged monkey without a weapon. He ripped his neck, he ripped his face, he ripped his arms, he ripped his leg, he ripped his crotch, he ripped his behind. Louis was ripped up pretty bad, and eventually, he took the monkey, I think he grabbed it and threw it out of the window. It just shows you, if he hadn't done it, he'd be dead today, okay? But a liberal today probably would have tried to talk to the monkey. Louis knew that the instincts had to kick in. It was him or the monkey. And he decided it was better him than the monkey. He didn't consult a liberal book on how to deal with a crazed monkey. He just fought with it and killed it. I think that's what the bottom line is here. But the point is that even a lonely drunk needs companionship at night. In his case, he found the monkey. It was probably the right thing for him to do. So right now you could see that Louis was a pioneer in a way, in a sense that he understood that monkeys were dangerous long before they did in India when they turned into a sacred animal.
Savage. Not a bad story. But the bottom line is, as I point out on page 195 in Louis the Crazed Monkey, even a lonely drunk needs companionship at night. And in his case, he found the monkey, and it was probably the right thing for him to do. All right, so what do? Monkeys are dangerous. It's as simple as that. And this is from my my book, Train Tracks, The Family Stories for the Holidays in paperback. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
Well, tonight we have a wonderful author on the show, Nelson DeMille, who's really a fabulous novelist. And you know, occasionally I like to talk about topics other than Obama, the debt ceiling, government shutdown. Again, joining us on the Savage Nation is Nelson DeMille, the New York Times best-selling novelist, who has recently re-released his first full-length novel entitled The Quest, which he has rewritten and expanded on. Nelson DeMille, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be back.
Nelson, I remember your earlier books, Nightfall, Plum Island, The Gatehouse, The Lion, The Panther, The Charm School, Word of Honor, The Gold Coast, and others, and I've enjoyed them. What is your new book, The Quest, about, and why did you rewrite it?
Yeah, you know, I did this book back in 1975 when I was a very young writer and very inexperienced writer. This is a book about a search for the Holy Grail. I'd written at a time when religious thrillers, per se, were starting to make a comeback, and of course they made a comeback big time with Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. But this was preceded Da Vinci Code by about 20 years. And after I saw Da Vinci Code, which I read and actually blurred, I said, you know, it's time to bring back The Quest. You don't normally bring back an older book, but this was a paperback original when it was first written and had a price tag of about $1.50 on the cover. And I estimate about 500 people read it, so they're probably all gone by now or they forgot what they read. So what I decided to do is rewrite it and bring it back. And here it is in 2013. And it just debuted at number 2 on the New York Times list.
You're not the first to write about the Holy Grail. Why do you think it's such a fascinating topic?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, this has been a topic, obviously, that's been around for well over 1,000 years. The Holy Grail, of course, is the cup used by Christ at the Last Supper. And this has been the subject of legend, myth, poems by Mallory, and also, poems by Lord Tennyson. And, of course, you have the Arthurian legends, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. And but more recently, we've had Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So it's really part of Western culture. And the interesting thing about it is it's not really part of church teachings. Whether you be Catholic or Protestant or anything in between. The church doesn't really recognize the Holy Grail per se, but what I find fascinating about it is it's really the people's. People say it's is folk legend. People have perpetuated this story for at least 1,000 years since the days of King Arthur, if not longer. And it sort of runs parallel to church teachings, but obviously it's a spiritual subject, but a more of a folk spiritual subject. And I think everybody's looking for their holy grail, no matter what their holy grail may be. And that's what I tried to do in this book, show that this was not just a search for an object, but a search for some kind of inner peace, if you will.
You are a former U.S. Army officer who served in Vietnam. Did any of your own personal experiences find their way into the book?
Yeah, you know, when I started writing this book, it was 1974, and I think I'd been out of the jungles of Vietnam for about 6 years at that point. And I hadn't really written my Vietnam War novel, but what I did is, I guess, I transferred my experiences as an infantry officer in Vietnam to this book. A lot of this book is set in the jungles of Ethiopia. So a lot of the jungle lore, so to speak, and the survival techniques that I learned when I was in Vietnam made it to this book without me having to, at that point, write my Vietnam War novel, which I actually did years later. So, yeah, it's my head was still in the jungles of Vietnam when I wrote this book.
The Quest was written by you originally in 1975. How much have you changed as a writer in those years?
Well, I got older. I got to be a better writer, for sure. You know, when I was rereading the old version, there were some moments where I kind of winced that the writing wasn't really up to the standards. But I saw that I had gotten the story right and the plot and the characters. The structure was good. I just needed, I think, better syntax and maybe better English. And what I noticed, too, as I was writing it, is I brought a lot more experiences, my personal experiences, into the book. And, you know, the book originally was about 75,000 words. Now it's about 140,000 words, just to give you an idea of what I did with it. I almost doubled the size, and I did a lot of rewriting. So it's in many ways, it's a new book, and the kind of book that I wish I could have written 40 years ago.
Look, I know when I'm writing novels, such as Abuse of Power or A Time for War, the book changes as it's written. Nelson, when you're writing, do you know how each character and story will end, or does it just grow organically?
Yeah, I try to make it grow organically, or the ending should be organic to the book. In this case, one of the few structural changes I made to the book was I changed the ending. The original ending, when I wrote it in 1975, was kind of a downer ending, which might be reflective of the period when I was writing it in the middle of the 1970s. The new ending's got a lot more upbeat, a little bit of a Hollywood ending, but I think a satisfying ending. So I think every writer has a problem with the ending, and there's different ways to go, and I think I had the luxury here of redoing the ending, which a lot of writers don't have, and I think I really came up with a great ending this time.
Nelson DeMille, what's next for you?
Well, you know, my most famous character, the one I guess I'm known for now, is the character of John Corey, and that's what I'm working on now, a new John Corey novel. And in the John Corey novel, I'm bringing back one of my older characters, Paul Brenner. Paul Brenner, you may remember, was the hero of The General's Daughter that was made into a feature film with John Travolta about 15 years ago. So I'm continuing the Corey character, and I like the idea of breaking it up once in a while. A lot of writers, as you know, just keep writing the same character over and over again, but I like to break it up with something different, which is one of the reasons I wrote The Quest. And I should say something about The Quest, too. It's a search for the Holy Grail, but I think your listeners like the idea that this is a book that's got a political element also. The book is set during the Marxist Revolution of 1975 in Ethiopia, when the Emperor Haile Selassie was deposed. This was a 3,000-year-old dynasty that was founded by the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon. And all of a sudden, the Marxists rose up, mostly through the military, and took over the government, imprisoned the Emperor Haile Selassie, and executed hundreds of members of the royal family. So the politics of the time was, you know, the ascendancy of Marxism, which was actually happening as I was writing the book in the 70s. It looked like the Marxists were going to take over the world. And we mentioned this in the book, that things have gone terribly wrong in the world. with things that are not right now, but the good news is that Marxism is pretty well dead, maybe not buried yet, but pretty well dead. But you get a glimpse of this when you read the Quest, because the whole thing is set against the background of the Marxist Revolution, reminding me, and a lot of readers, a little bit of a Dr. Zhivago feeling.
I suppose your book is in every bookstore in the country. I suggest they go out and buy The Quest when they're looking for my book, Train Tracks, in paperback.
Well, you can go on nelsondeville.net and get two chapters for free. And if you like those, the book is available all over. Let's say it debuted at number 2 in New York Times. And it's an e-book. It's an audio book, an audio download. And wherever you like to go buy your bricks and mortar book, Barnes & Noble and other stores, all available all over the country right now.
Again, Nelson DeMille, thanks for being with us on The Savage Nation.
Thank you, Michael.
855-407-2282 is the phone number. MichaelSavage.com is the website. I mean, I could talk about the hatred going on coming out of the Democrat Party, and you can see where the hatred comes from. The hate talk is coming from Barbara Boxer, comparing it to spousal abuse. The hate talk is coming from Nancy Pelosi, talking about things you can't believe. It's all hate talk. They're the most hateful people on the planet. And you have the Republicans. They're basically nice guys, most of them. They don't know what to do.
Savage.